Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. Tonight, the topic, award shows. Joining me as my only guest is Aaron White. So tonight, please say hello.
Hello.
Yep. So tonight, we are discussing award shows and how television and these shows have influenced one another over the decades. So where do you want to begin?
Let's I guess, jump right in. I think that the Oscars are really the major influence on the Emmys, and ultimately the Emmys are the major influence on peak TV. So I think ultimately the Oscars could be said to be responsible for the golden age of television that we're either in or just left, depending on who you talk to.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, now there have been other shows that have come around since the dawn of television. Shows like, you know, the Tonys, the Grammys, you know, obviously things like the People's Choice Awards. But I don't really want to get into that too much tonight. You know, the purview of this show is obviously movies and television, and so we're going to stick pretty much today. It's going to stick to Golden Globes, Oscars, and Emmys. So to that end, do you have an award? No, I'm not even going to ask that. To that end, how did you first start watching award show? What was your introduction? What are some of your early memories of watching award shows?
My earliest memories, I guess, were all with the Grammys and their performances. The first time I really sat down and watched the Oscars was the 2003 awards for the 2004 awards for the 2003 movies. And I was in high school and I was a nerd and I had wind that Lord of the Rings was going to have a very good night. And so I decided that, let's give this a shot. So I watched that year, and it was super exciting. Nothing like that has happened since, which is not a bad thing, but every year there's a movie that I think going into the season might have a chance, and it never does. which, if there was a huge sweep every year, it would be really boring. So I love the competitive races we've been seeing the last few years, but that big sweep was my first experience with the Oscars.
Yeah. Now, mine, you know, I remember watching shows back when I was younger. Obviously, some of the shows in the 80s when I was a kid. I think the first time I really remember the Oscars as the Oscars, I remember, and this goes to how television has influenced the Oscars, because, you know, the Oscars started out as just this little dinner. Everybody knew in advance that they'd won or not, and they were just supposed to come and thank the studio for giving them the award because, you know, really that's what it was. It was the studios congratulating themselves and promoting each other. Well, what I ended up seeing was Rob Lowe and Snow White. And thinking that, and I was a kid, I was about 8 or 9, and I thought that was one of the most unfortunate things I'd ever seen in my whole life. You know, yet it was so awful that I couldn't turn away from the Oscars. And I had to keep watching the Oscars and the Emmys and the Golden Globes. And, you know, then, of course, later on in 95 when they were honoring the 94 films, I remember seeing Sam Jackson go, fuck, when he lost for Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, that made me go from just slightly watching, you know, the Emmys and the Oscars to really, really paying full attention to them, because you never knew what was going to happen. And I do think that television is vital in keeping award shows going, not just because of revenue, but just in that interest of watching the crazy shit that might happen. So what do you think?
Was there a better moment on live TV in the last decade than when Warren Beatty announced that La La Land had won Best Picture? I mean, those are the moments that live TV was made for. It's not made for when things go off without a hitch. It's made for when everything goes out. And, you had The Rock in the audience looking like he was about to show someone what he was cooking. You had Meryl Streep looking completely aghast. And Ryan Gosling's up on stage cracking up the whole time.
No, and then, you know, the way that Justin Horowitz was so gracious in Ultimate Defeat when they were informed, as he said, no, this is no joke. Moonlight has actually won. No, we're not kidding.
Yeah, and then shows the card, which became a memeable moment. Oh man!
No, it's great stuff. But you know, there's things like hell. I remember the some of the Lifetime Achievement Awards over the years, particularly some of the Emmy ones. I remember, like, the Mr. Rogers and the Agnes Nixon. Now, for those of you who don't know who Agnes Nixon is, and I'm talking the daytime Emmys in this case, Agnes Nixon was a soap opera writer and creator, as well as a producer for a while. She's known for All My Children, One Life to Live, Loving, but she also had legendary stints at Guiding Light, Another World, and I believe also As the World Turns. Just one of the landmark figures in daytime drama. And she gave a lovely, lovely speech. You know, there's the moment when Susan Lucci finally, after like 18 times, won. The guy that I think it was Shamar Moore from Young and the Restless screamed, "Oh my God, the streak is over!" And everybody knew exactly what it was, what he was talking about, what had happened.
Yeah.
But you know, these are the moments that you live for. Again, you know, and if you like award shows, and this is again why television and award shows seem almost tailor-made for each other. I think if television went away today, we wouldn't have award shows anymore, because we no longer think of just like handing out an award, like, you know, let's just give somebody
quietly
an entertainment.
Give someone an award.
Yeah, it's you know, you have to have a show and you have to telecast it, you know, otherwise you're doing, you know, some sort of academic thing. And
well, yeah, I mean, it wasn't that long before the Oscars were on the radio. So, I mean, most of their history, it has been a broadcast show.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, television brought a lot more glitz and glamour because all of a sudden you had a visual aspect to it. But, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, So in terms of the Oscars, do you have any, you know, we're going to make this a really kind of a loose show tonight. A lot of this is just going to be favorite moments, least favorite moments. But do you have any other moments from the Oscars over the last maybe 20, 30 years? And I know you only really started watching them about 17, 18 years ago, but you've surely seen clips from earlier shows or read in material about wins and losses. So moments that maybe you think are just superb or maybe not so, so superb.
I have four that have come to mind as we've discussed this. The first was brought on when you mentioned Lifetime Achievement Awards. And it was Jim Carrey presenting to Robert Altman. And I have to say, I was very unfamiliar with his work still at the point that he won the Lifetime Achievement Award. I knew Popeye, which I grew up with. And I knew Gosford Park. And Jim Carrey, who was a hero of mine at that point, presented this award, lovely speech, and then only came up looking like a Muppet, literally like a Muppet. Like, he was just so old at that point. And it was striking me how sad it was that he never got his moment when he was a younger man. The second one, obviously, the win that shocks the world, Marissa Tomei. When she was giving her speech, everyone was just covering their mouth, like, how did she win? What kind of vote split magic happened here? just one of the most shocking moments that I'm aware of. Martin Scorsese finally winning Best Director and being handed the award by Coppola, Spielberg, and Lucas was a very lovely moment. And most recent, Spike Lee finally winning and jumping into Sam Jackson's arms like a little kid in his purple pimp suit. It was magic. It was pure magic watching that moment.
No, that was great. The only thing that could have really made that night better is if the film and he had won director and picture, but I digress.
Or if anything other than Green Book had won Best Picture. Well, or Bohemian Rhapsody, which was just awful.
I see a little silhouette of a award show that used to not be so bad. Or maybe it always was terrible. No, Bohemian Rhapsody was pretty fucking bad. I mean, main actor was great, but let's be honest, the rest of the film, it's an exercise in imitation rather than exploration, and that's not any way to do a biography.
Nope. Not to mention that it made some pretty inflammatory implications that it was Freddie Mercury's homosexuality that caused him to be a jackass, not that he happened to be a jack and a homosexual.
Mm-hmm. Which is unfortunate given the film was, you know, directed by a gay man, I guess,
yes,
until the last, like, 2 weeks when he left in disgrace. But... But yeah, so you know, usually this show does The Emmys. We cover the Emmys a lot. We cover TV on this show, so the Emmys seem to be a good place to go. Now, you know, there was a run here until the last few years, but there was a run for about 6-7 years where the Emmys seemed to just be knocking it out of the park in terms of drama series wins with shows like The Sopranos and Mad Men, Breaking Bad, Homeland, all winning.
West Wing.
Mm-hmm. And and the thing is how can I put it? Game of Thrones should never have won an Emmy for Best Drama.
You know, I'm even okay with one of them because it was such a technical masterpiece. It caught the zeitgeist in a way that it's hard for fantasy to do, especially premium network fantasy. I'm okay with one, but it tying Mad Men and West Wing and blanking all of a sudden on the third show to win 4 Emmys is absolutely insane.
Yeah. The, you know, as we were discussing the other day before the show, there is, There's been a lot of weirdness with award shows over the years, and you know one of my favorite things to do has always been you know to go over a category or two and say hey what should have won, what should have been nominated. Let's see. And we'll get back to the Emmys in a minute, I guess. But, no, I guess we will stick with the Emmys. So, you know, I'll give people an idea of what I was talking about out here. The last, I'll do the last 5 or 6 years of the Emmys. And what I'd come up with is, obviously, 2015 Game of Thrones won. But I suggested that Better Call Saul or Mad Men should have won and that the Americans should have been nominated. Again, Game of Thrones won the following year, and I said either Better Call Saul or the Americans should have won. The Handmaid's Tale won, and I said Better Call Saul should have won. I think you people out there can notice a pattern. I'm a huge fan of Better Call Saul. Game of Thrones won again, and I think the Americans should have won. Game of Thrones won, but Better Call Saul was our
Americans' fourth season.
Yeah. That was their last season. And then
one
Game of Thrones
of
won again.
Seasons.
Oh, yeah. And then Game of Thrones won, but it should have been Better Call Saul, Ozark, or Pose. And then last year, Succession won, and it should have been Ozark, Better Call Saul, and Pose should have been up. You know, so it's these sorts of things that are the fun things that we do with award shows. And I think that's one of the benefits. Maybe not benefits, but that's one of the one of the fun things, if you follow award shows at all, people ask me, well, why do you follow them? Isn't it all about glitz and glamour? And I'm like, no, it's about the wins and the losses and the what-ifs and should-have-beens. And, you know, it's no different than there was a book on baseball once called Leveling the Field where it took a sabermetric look at all the old records and decided, and it was really interesting because it reimagined all the old records using sabermetrics. And I don't think it's really any different than that. You know, a game of what if is a nice parlor game, and that's really all award shows ever should be to me. You know, I'm sure there's going to be people out there that go, no, they mean something to the people that win. And, of course, they do. And it's nice to get the acknowledgement from your peers. But in the end, you know, winning the award for Best Director isn't going to be the difference between life and death for anyone.
Yeah.
It may get you a few more dollars in your bank account, but that's about it.
I do think there is, on top of all of that, a cultural aspect. And that may be more on the voters than on the viewers. But you see that tension with what's happening in the world is influencing what's happening on these shows. So we mentioned Green Book earlier. It won Best Picture a couple of years ago. It was a view of it was a race buddy movie in a time when we had a lot of racial disunity, which is still going on, but it was really catching fire at that point. And it was also the safe race movie. They weren't going to go with, say, Black Panther, because that was too safe. It was a comic book movie that made over $1 billion. You can't, they're not going to give the first comic book movie ever to be nominated Best Picture the award. It's just not going to happen. And then there was Black Klansman, which was not safe, because Spike Lee doesn't make safe movies.
No, Spike Lee couldn't make
really
a safe movie.
That movie tapped into what was really happening better than any other movie of that year, on a macro level, but it was Dynamite, and you don't see Dynamite winning Best Picture too often.
No. Every once in a while, it does, but you know, sometimes it's more like a little firecracker than true Dynamite.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing it more and more, I think, with the Best Director category right now, as we divert into the Oscars. Hopefully we can divert back into the Emmys at some point. But one of the last 10 awards has gone to a white American male. Because it's not that white American males aren't making great movies anymore. It's because it's time to recognize the fact that they're not the only people making great movies. And it capitalized the last 2 years when foreign language films broke through for the first two times, and they did it back-to-back with Roma and Parasite winning Best Director the last 2 years.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. There have been some real great wins and also some real head scratchers at the Oscars.
Absolutely.
You know, you just look at God. Let's play the game again. Let's look at the last like few winners. Last year it was Bong Joon-ho, and I think that Bong Joon-ho was a perfectly fine winner. I also wouldn't have minded Sam Mendes, Martin Scorsese, or even Quentin Tarantino, who really did evoke a certain sense of place and time character with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The previous year, Alfonso Cuarón won for Roma, but you know, Yorgos Lanthimos or Spike Lee probably should have won for their films instead. And that's no disrespect to Cuarón, but this is a problem with the Oscars that I want to take a second to point out. It's not always that the person that wins didn't deserve to win. It's a lot of times that it's the third or fourth best nominee that wins. And that's not always, you know, that the people that win, again, didn't do good work, or that they're third or fourth best because, you know, the other, they're bad. But it's just that sometimes, you know, people complain about the Oscars, but the Oscars often have great nominees and then give the award to the middle of the pack person. And as you said, it's because Oscar plays it safe.
Yeah. And I'll say, Roma was my favorite movie that year. I was rooting for it in the best picture category, but I really wanted Spike Lee to win best director. It was his moment. It was his film. It was the film that spoke to the moment better than anything else that year. And so I was really rooting for Spike to win best director that year. Despite my love for Roma. I totally agree with that.
And then, you know, the year before you have Guillermo del Toro winning for The Shape of Water, and honestly, he really deserved it, although I wouldn't have been upset to see Greta Gerwig get it for Lady Bird. The previous year, Damien Chazelle got it for La La Land, and while it was a perfectly good win, Barry Jenkins,
it was a bravura performance by a director,
or Denis Villeneuve really should have gotten it for their films.
Oh yeah, and Barry Jenkins, I introduced us to this really beautiful poetic realism that we don't see that often ever, especially in American films, especially in American films that are about heavy social topics. And he brought this sense of romance.
Growing up black and gay.
Yeah, in inner city Miami.
Can I just interrupt for just a second and say Mel Gibson shouldn't have been up for Hacksaw Ridge? It should have been Scorsese for Silence.
He was, wasn't he?
Nope.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Damon Chazelle for La La Land, Mel Gibson for Hacksaw, Barry Jenkins for Moonlight, Kenneth Lonergan for Manchester.
Yeah, I misunderstood what you were saying. Yes, Scorsese for Silence should have been up. And where was I? Oh, yeah, this sense of romance, capital R romance, that you don't see in socially aware movies ever. Usually socially aware movies are so conscious about what they're saying that all of the energy is put into the message and not the way they're telling the message. And Jenkins worked around that in such a beautiful way. At least he won Best Picture.
Yeah. Now we haven't talked too much about the Golden Globes. So how would you describe the Golden Globes, a bacchanal?
Yeah, that was. And it's put on by foreign paper critics. And so they're much more concerned with the glitz and glamour. And they want to see celebrities win. I admit they've had some great wins. They've had some head scratchers though. 2010 award cycle for the 2009 movies. They actually gave Avatar the best picture win over the Hurt Locker, which I won't say the Hurt Locker was not my favorite movie that year. It was one of them. I think it was number two for me. But everybody was going with the Hurt Locker that year. It was a steamroller, in a way that I don't think we've seen since, where it was just so obvious what was going to win Best Picture. And they went with Dances with Smurfs.
Yeah, and now, you know, the Globes have always been, marked by controversy. In 1958, Henry Grease, then the president of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, resigned, saying that certain awards had been given more or less as favors. And there was indeed one single public relations firm that represented a majority of the winners.
Oh, jeez.
There's, of course, the Pia Zadora thing where she won New Star of the Year female for her performance in Butterfly in 1982, despite the fact that she'd actually debuted 17 years earlier as a child in Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. And this followed the fact that her husband, a multimillionaire, had flown voting members to his casino in Las Vegas.
this new one, though, is a granddaddy. It really puts Oscars so light to bed. The fact that they haven't had a single black voting member in, 20 years now?
Yeah.
And did you see Ava DuVernay's comments?
No, I didn't.
Yesterday? She said that they invited her for a Q&A for When They See Us, which was a nominee at the Golden Globes a couple of years ago. Lost to Chernobyl. But she said once they got into the Q&A that they just ran right through it. It was obvious that over half of the members hadn't even bothered to watch the series, and they just wanted her there for the selfies. And the shaking hands and stuff. And it was just such a sad thing to read about this widely respected and beloved, for lack of a better word, miniseries.
Well, you know, that was a great, great show, and both of them deserved it. But it's unfortunate mm-hmm. when you get the feeling from people like DuVernay, who I have no reason to doubt her word, given everything we've heard about the lack of credibility for the Hollywood Foreign Press, that they did that. That's another thing that we need to get into, the lack of credibility these award shows have, and this is another reason why I say, hey, it's fun, but, they don't really mean shit at the end of the day. To Ava DuVernay, who I know is not listening to this podcast, this radio show, but if she was, I'd tell her, look, fuck the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. Your work will stand forever as the greatness it is, and let that be the legacy of your show.
Oh, absolutely.
But she's not right to point out the bullshit, because that shit can't stand. That's not respectful to a filmmaker, to an artist, to the people who did all the hard work. You know, when you get called in and you think you're giving an honest, shot.
Well, and it makes it look like the nomination was strictly, everyone else is nominating this, we better too, or we'll look bad.
Yeah, and it also, you know, I'm thinking here, it also makes it look like, we just don't want to talk because we've already made up our mind who's going to win, and we're going to give you the chance to try to convince us. Because let's be honest, if there's ever been bribery in a at an awards show, it happened at the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
I mean, they've actually caught people, literally caught people doing it, or seemingly doing it over the years. And you know, the fact that they don't have any real true minorities in the Hollywood Foreign Press is a problem. Not that, you know, and the idea, and, you know, this idea, there is this idea that, well, we need to have minority representation so that they'll vote for their own people, which is a terrible, terrible assumption to make. No, you want equal representation and diverse representation so that you can have diverse voices hopefully discussing and adding in their voices, which may or may not go the way you would assume. And we all know what assumptions make of you and me.
Yeah. Now, I will point out that since AMPAS, the Academy, had such a huge influx of international voters over the last 5 or 6 years, that we have had a huge influx of foreign films being represented outside of the international category. So it does it does help. Not necessarily in the way you expect.
Right. And the thing is I think that's why you're seeing things like Paul Pawlowski being up for Cold War, Vinterberg this year for Another Round, which I still need to find a copy of that so I can watch it.
You can rent it on Prime or iTunes or any of those at this point.
Yeah. I've only seen a couple of other Vinterberg films, but they're very interesting. But, you know, I think I find it interesting that he's the one person from the Dogma 95 group that's finally gotten recognition, because Lars von Trier never did.
I mean, he did in his own way. He just keeps sabotaging himself by being a moron.
Well, you know, Lars von Trier is such a provocateur. If you've ever seen his show, The Kingdom, which Stephen King later turned into Kingdom Hospital with the aid of the unproduced third season scripts that von Trier handed him, he gave these really bizarre, tongue-in-cheek openings that were like some sort of Scandinavian, Nordic, Alfred Hitchcock, naughty boy deal. You know, you can tell that it wasn't all an act.
I mean, Kirsten Dunst, God love her, was marching her way to an Oscar win for Melancholia. She dominated the panel at Cannes, and she was going to ride that wave all the way home. And he totally derailed not just her performance, but the whole film, which was, I had it as my number one film in 2010. He derailed the whole thing by making comments that could be easily construed as Nazi sympathetic for no reason. Like, it wasn't even about the film. It was just, oh, you did that.
And you know, and here's another thing. Those comments were carried on radio and television around the world. It wasn't just a newspaper. There was no doubt about what the fuck happened.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you know, award shows are fun. But I mean, if, you know, I would have to say that I've always considered the Golden Globes a distant third to the Emmys and the Oscars. And for a while here, I really was enjoying the Emmys more than the Oscars. But right now I have to say I'm not enjoying any of them because they've all become so damn predictable. The Emmys with the front runner always fucking winning, the Oscars with the front runners mostly winning. You know, I miss the days of the upsets, which are part of what made for good television. And you just don't get that anymore.
You're getting some of it in the best picture category because of the preferential ballot. But
you know, you get stuff like everybody thought it was going to be Glenn Close. I had a feeling that Olivia Colman could sneak in
right.
for the favorite. But, you know, but that was kind of an upset, though not really, because she was really kind of
the
second.
Yeah, the
but
really,
Close was such a favorite.
The big one in recent memory was Bong Joon-ho upsetting Sam Mendes in Best Director last year. But I think that if you had any idea how much, like, the acting branch and the writing branch loved that movie,
yeah,
you would have known that it was a threat in every category.
Yeah. But go on.
I had a question for you. In your estimation, what was the worst series to ever win Best Drama at the Emmys?
Oh, good Lord. The absolute worst series to ever win Best Drama. Like one where it was actively bad?
Or, you know, actively not good anyway. I'm not as familiar with the history of the Emmys as you are. So maybe one doesn't exist. So,
you know, I'm not sure that an actively bad show has won. I mean, there's been a lot of shows that you might look and scratch your head and go, wait, really? They gave it to that? I mean, you know, you could maybe look at something like Police Story or The Senator, but those are shows that were considered fine at the time. Police Story is actually pretty much a classic of its time. You know, there were certain seasons of shows that definitely shouldn't have won. I may actually go, as much as I don't like Game of Thrones winning, I don't think it's a bad show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with the most recent one, Succession. I don't think it's a particularly good show. I don't think it's a bad show. I just don't think it's a great one. It may have been my mood when I watched season one, which I watched.
It's not speaking to you, though.
No, it's not speaking to me. I saw the first season in a, you know, I saw the first season and it just didn't work for me. I didn't go back to season two. So I can't talk to season two deserving, but if it's anything like season one,
and season two is the one that won, right?
Yeah, because season one lost to
the
final season of Game of Thrones.
Okay.
Which I actually didn't didn't hate the final season of Game of Thrones. I've always been one to say that just because a show or a movie or a book goes in an unexpected direction or a direction that you didn't think it should go, that's not enough to say it was bad. Was it poorly executed? Was it poorly acted? Did any of it actually make any sense? Can you see that
just because it disappoints
plan?
You doesn't mean it's bad.
Right. You know, but you see this a lot in science fiction and fantasy, maybe more than any other genre. You know, I'm thinking of the spoiled Star Wars fans that chase actresses off of social media because of how pissed they are that there's a female character central to a Star Wars movie that isn't fan-wanking them enough.
Yeah.
But I'll always always like Last Jedi just because it went so many unexpected places.
Yes. It made you feel like everything was possible in that universe again.
Yeah, and then the next movie, the next movie may be the worst movie in the whole franchise, and that's saying something given this is a franchise that has Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. Although I guess I keep forgetting about Solo, but Solo...
Solo
doesn't exist.
I put Rise of the Skywalker just above Phantom Menace, which I put just above Attack of the Clones, which I put way above Solo. I think that movie could have worked had it been just Donald Glover as Lando, but we that's a different show.
So no, we've got a lot of other things we can discuss about award shows, but is there anything we haven't brought up yet that you'd like to?
Ooh. Let's throw another impromptu question at you. What was your favorite movie from this year that wasn't Oscar nominated? I have a very clear answer on this one, so I'm curious if you'll say the same.
Well, I'll let you go first.
I'm thinking of Ending Things, which I think, even though it was year one of the decade, has potential to be amongst the best films of the decade.
Well, I think it's possibly Charlie Kaufman's best movie as a writer or a director. And this is the guy that gave us Sinatra adaptation, Anna Melissa, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So this is no slouching preacher that we're speaking of. I'm going to forget Being John Malkovich, which pissed me off at its absurdity, and not because I don't like absurd things, but just because I have a real hatred for that film. There's something that just irks me about it almost to the point of irrationality, and I don't want to go off the deep end on the show tonight.
I'm going to jump in here because I'm actually reading Charlie Kaufman's novel right now, and he mocks Being John Malkovich as nothing but a Kiss Me Stupid lampoon.
Oh, fuck. What? Oh. Well, you know,
know if those actually express Mr. Kaufman's feelings about his first film, his first screenplay, but it was really funny hearing the character in his book saying that Kiss Me Stupid was 30 years before being John Malkovich having a big movie lampoon himself.
But no, I'm Thinking of Ending Things is a very special film.
Oh, it really is. And once again, Jesse Plemons proves that turn for the limelight. He's not a classic movie star, but he's got star quality to him, regardless.
Well, you know, he just got the lead in the Martin Scorsese movie because Leonardo DiCaprio decided to scale back.
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is not the first time he's worked with Scorsese. That would be very interesting. Yeah, it would actually be very interesting if DiCaprio, you know, because it looks like it went from De Niro to Scorsese always working with De Niro to Scorsese always working with DiCaprio, and is he now in the in what will probably become the twilight of his career? Just unfortunately, given his age, is he going to make his last few movies with Jesse Plemons?
Let's see. I mean, he has brought De Niro back as well, because De Niro will also be in the new one.
Yeah. That's going to be interesting, having his two biggest stars in terms of consistent leads, although some might argue Keitel, though I don't think Keitel was ever really his lead. It was always a support.
Yeah, except for in the first two, like Who's That Knocking on My Door and Mean Streets were really the two.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess I always think of De Niro in Mean Streets, but that's probably just because of the how good De Niro was in a film that
De Niro was so great. I would say Keitel is the Scorsese character. And I think that's why people confuse him as one of Scorsese's leads. I think they're good friends in real life. I think that Keitel really understands Scorsese. And I think they started together. But I think that Keitel has always been more of a player.
Mm-hmm. Well, he definitely was in The Irishman.
Yes.
He basically sits at a table in, what, two or three scenes?
Yeah.
Which, trust me, it's awesome to see all those actors in the same movie, but you know, let's be real. and of course, we all know that the Oscar for Best Director of 2021 is going to go to Zack Snyder for 2017's Justice League. No, I digress. We had to make that joke, folks, because at this moment in history, for those listening to this radio show in the years to come, the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League had just been released yesterday on March 18th on HBO Max, and you know, it's the hot topic of discussion on social media in terms of movies and television right now. It's actually, to be completely honest, it is quite a phenomenon, isn't it, right now?
Oh, it's the biggest movie event. Well, since Marvel did Endgame, at least, which was a whole different kind of event. That was the culmination of a decades-long story. This is the culmination of 5 years in hell for Snyder and the people who rightfully hated what Joss Whedon did to Zack Snyder's film.
Yeah, and, you know...
Well, and Warner Brothers. Let's not let them off the hook.
particularly two suits that took a golden parachute after torpedoing what Snyder was building with the DC Universe. And, you know, like
yes.
it or loathe it, you know, you can't accuse Snyder of not having a vision. And since he left, the one thing the DC Universe has been accused of, and rightfully so, is not having much of a sense of direction.
Yeah, it's reported by his wife, so I'm going to take it at face value, that she and Christopher Nolan watched the movie together and told him, never see this version of the movie. It will rip your heart out. Because let's not forget that Christopher Nolan was also an architect of this. As overrated as I find Nolan, he and Zack Snyder built this thing together. And it was is Snyder's vision, but Nolan really brought the heavyweight of the name recognition and the critical clout.
Yeah.
And he brought Snyder in, right?
Yeah, because I know back, you know, originally people wanted Nolan, after the success of his Batman trilogy, to be the guy in charge, but he was like, no. He said it's got to be Snyder. Look what he did with Watchmen. Maybe he was right.
And he was ready to move on, I think.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, and Nolan had other pursuits. Nolan wanted to do things like Tenet and Inception and all that, and, you know, good for him. He did do Dunkirk. Now, you know, let's get back to the Oscars a bit. Dunkirk,
yep.
There's a movie that was considered the front runner. In recent years, has a front runner that ended up making it into the final 8 or 10, fallen off as quickly in the last 3 or 4 years as Dunkirk did. Because when Dunkirk was announced, it looked like this was going to sweep everything. There was going to be like the winner of 10 Oscars and be the biggest thing since English Patient.
Yeah, Dunkirk... That was a really weird season because Dunkirk had that happen, and then Three Billboards did too. Both of them looked like they were going to be monsters for a very brief moment in time. Shape of Water came on late. It mm-hmm. came out just before Christmas, if memory serves. And here is one of the most beloved Mexican filmmakers at a time when the American president is being very unfriendly to Mexicans, making a film about being an outsider, and it hit the sweet spot. As I've mentioned, the Oscars ultimately are a cultural phenomenon. The voters in the Oscars are real people, and as much as we like to glamorize them, they're real people, they have real feelings, they like to be moved, and The Shape of Water was such a gorgeous film, as we discussed in the Guillermo del Toro episode a couple weeks ago. And it hit the right time, it hit the right topic, and it was the right man for the job. But, yeah, no, Dunkirk, it came out early. It did. It came out in July, which isn't, I mean, considering that Get Out came out that year in February and was arguably second place when all was said and done in many categories. July doesn't seem too early, but it is early. for these kinds of movies.
You know, speaking of second place, I really do wish that even if there was a moratorium of, say, 5 years on it or 10 years, I wish that the tabulating firm, whether it be PricewaterhouseCoopers or whatever, whichever one they're using that year, would release the vote placements for the Oscars and the Emmys every year. That would be really
totally
fun. You know, I don't need to know who voted, obviously. I don't even particularly want to know. But I'd like to get a sense of how close things were.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think it was when Shakespeare in Love won. I think they must have at one point actually listed the win place show or something on the ballot, because I remember I want to say it was the year that Harrison Ford announced Shakespeare in Love, and he started to say, "And the award goes to Shakespeare in Love." He was about to say Saving Private Ryan, because he was certain it was going to go to Saving Private Ryan. And that's why they brought Harrison Ford out, was to have Harrison Ford hand it to Steven Spielberg. That didn't happen. And I think that was the year that the producer of the film said, it was close. And that indicates to me that they must have at least at one point had some of the winners and the not winners listed on the same sheet, and I'd love to know what they were, because you know you have to know that in a year like Shakespeare in Love and Saving Private Ryan, that must have been awful close. And I have a feeling going with the Spielberg film again, that as great as Schindler's List is, I have a feeling that The Piano had a lot of support that year.
What a gorgeous film that is too.
It really is. It really, really is. And you know, I'd love to know if Lord of the Rings, the first one, if the first Lord of the Rings really come as close to winning Best Picture as people think it did.
Yeah, and then what happens if it had? Like, would it have affected that sweep, the Return of the King sweep? Because a lot of people, myself included, have the feeling that the Return of the King sweep was indicative of, let's award the franchise.
And that is one of the rare instances where I actually don't mind it, because
I agree.
Really were three films. It really was one film split up into three parts.
Yep. Just like,
but I also have a feeling like Spotlight that Spotlight, Revenant, and Mad Max Fury Road weren't separated by much in 2015. You know, I really do think that we probably had some Emmy wins that were very close, like, despite the fact that people say, well, there was a lot of resentment with HBO and The Sopranos as interlopers in 99, and that's why they went with The Practice. I actually think that The Practice probably won by a small percentage of the vote over The Sopranos.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, you get into Spotlight, and you're getting into the preferential ballot. And I would love, if nothing else, to see how many rounds it took on the preferential ballot for these movies to win. Because that thing's bonkers. For those who don't know, everyone votes on their top three choices. And the film that gets the least amount of votes, or if no film gets 50% plus one vote, they drop the lowest film and they go again. And so it's kind of a really crazy, complicated voting system they have for Best Picture right now. And so I would really like to know, especially with Spotlight and Green Book, how many ballots it took. Because you know, and I know, that Roma and Black Klansman got more number one votes than Green Book did.
If it didn't, if it really didn't, if we're wrong, then that's a shame. But, you know, this actually reminds me of when Lance Armstrong used to, the Tour de France by simply pacing himself so that he was always within the top two or three. He very rarely ever won a stage of the Tour de France. He simply accumulated enough points. Kind of reminds me of this one friend I played with that would occasionally beat me in Mario Kart by always taking second place and
hitting you with a blue shell at the last minute.
And hitting me at a blue shell and making me end up in third twice, so that even if I hit 1-1, it would be 1-1-3-3, and he'd have 2-2-2, and just barely point me, and I'm like, you son of a Ducksworth. But yeah, the blue shell, the spiky shell. I can even hear that horrible woo 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 woo. No. Because ain't nothing going to stop that blue shell from getting your ass.
Nope.
Not if you're in first place. Although I guess you could always drop back to second place, but that's dangerous to do at the finish line.
Yes.
I did actually do one time to him, and the shell hit him. I have to admit that. He shelled himself. I think it must have been a glitch in the game, because I don't think that's supposed to happen, but it did.
Yeah, I don't think so. But maybe because the timing of it.
Yeah, but we have so much that we could say about award shows, but do you have any moments that you look at like that Snow White Rob Lowe moment, be it the Emmys, the Globes, or the Oscars, and you just shake your head at how pathetic it is?
Oh, man. You know, I cannot remember why, but there was this in memoriam, I'm going to say about a decade ago, 2007, 2008, somewhere in there. I guess closer to 15 years now. Wow. Anyway, it just felt so bad. Like, it didn't feel respectful. It didn't feel sad. It just was bad. And I wish I could remember who the performer and what year it was. But the other one was the entire 2009 for 2008 movie Oscars. That whole thing was a disaster. Slumdog Millionaire winning. Harvey Weinstein really flexing his muscles for the last time. And speaking of, we all know now that Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan because he was flexing his muscles behind the scene in more ways than we ever could have imagined at the time.
Which is a damn shame, because Shakespeare in Love is a really fun film that really celebrates the joy of creating art in a way that few films had at that point. I hate the fact that film's legacy has become, DreamWorks winning a series of Oscars they probably shouldn't have. It's people resenting the film for winning simply because of Harvey Weinstein being one of the most odious forces ever to hit Hollywood.
Well, to be fair, they resented it before that because Steven Spielberg is so beloved.
Yeah, but, you know, let's be honest. Saving Private Ryan could have won. Shakespeare mm-hmm. in Love could have won. Shakespeare in Love did win. And I'm no great Malick fan.
I was about to bring that up.
But The Thin Red Line made the biggest artistic
that
achievement that year. Although I'll be completely honest, my favorite film of 1998 was Pleasantville.
Pleasantville was such a gorgeous film. The Truman Show also was another film that hit me really hard.
Yep.
I saw that when it came out, and it stuck with me almost 25 years later. It's one of my first forays into truly serious cinema. And it stuck with me. It spoke to me.
Yeah, and to be completely honest, 98 has another film that I would have put in, and that's The Red Violin.
I thought that was 99.
Nope, it hit the United States in 99, but it played the festival circuit in 98, got its release in its home country of Canada in 98, then hit the United Kingdom and the United States wide release in 99, but it's actually
okay, so it won best score for the 1999 circuit, right?
Right, and that's the thing. That's something else that we need to talk about. Is some of these awards, you know, especially with the Oscars. It's funny sometimes you'll see films, particularly foreign films, that get nominated based on when they're released here instead of when they're released there. There was a recent controversy with the absolutely stunning German film Never Look Away from the great Fabian von Donsmark that was easily among my top three or four films for 2018. But most U.S. critics reserved it for their 2019 list, despite the fact that it got nominated at for the 2018 Oscars,
right.
Because the Oscars decided to give it to films based on year of release in their native country rather than year of release here.
Well, there's two time marks for the now international award. It's determined by year of release in native, and for at general awards, it's for Los Angeles release. You don't see it come up too often, but Battle of Algiers won best foreign film 2 years before it won, was nominated for best director.
That is unusual. Now, have you ever seen Battle of Algiers?
Oh, it's incredible. it's one of my favorite war films.
And you know the thing is
a gross war film.
I have a really unusual relationship to a lot of Italian films in the 50s and 60s that aren't westerns or made by by Rossellini and that crew. I'm not a big Fellini fan. I'll admit. I know I can hear the gasps around the world. But good Lord, what Pontesorvo made here is just an all-time film.
It's true. Like, it took someone who was not French or Algerian to make that film. It's one of those cases where it had to be an outsider because it had to be completely objective. It had to show us just the facts and not moralize on either side and let us make the decision. There are times when it's okay to moralize. There are times when it's not. Truly talented filmmakers know when those moments are.
Battle of Algiers
was not that moment.
You know, and speaking about moralizing, I'm going to say this. Dan Curtis and Herman Woke moralizing a bit in Winds of War, especially War and Remembrance, when it comes to the Holocaust sequences in War and Remembrance, that's absolutely warranted and absolutely earned. As much as War and Remembrance is often a good, maybe not great, soap, the war sequences, and particularly the Holocaust sequences, make it one of the all-time series. And I know that, you know, people got pissed when it won Best Miniseries that year. But it really did, it really was a hell of a of an achievement.
Yeah. And something like that, which is just the with the Holocaust specifically, that's just universally repugnant to anyone who is not a literal Nazi.
I have to tell the story.
It's okay to moralize there.
Well, you know, and speaking of that, you know, Dan Curtis, he'd had this huge success with Winds of War, and he wasn't really sure he wanted to go through the process again, but his wife told him, hey, look, you know you want to do it. Come on. You know you want to do it. That's why you can't find another project, because you know that you want to do it. You're just afraid of being that tired again. and so he went with Woke to ABC, who held the rights but the option. But they held a very interesting option, an option where Woke had final say. Woke had agreed to let them do it as long as Dan Curtis was brought back. Dan Curtis told ABC, you have to give me essentially carte blanche in how I approach this. You're going to let me show the Holocaust with all the violence, vulgarity, and nudity that it requires to be as unflinching as we can possibly be, and standards and practices can basically go to hell. The FCC be damned. And the result was truly, truly stunning work. There's seriously never been anything like it on American television before in terms of its depictions of the horrors of Holocaust. And I honestly don't really know if anything has been done on television since, except maybe some stuff over in Europe.
Yeah, and the FCC, I mean, we all hate them. We're all anti-censorship here. But they are usually very forgiving when it comes to stuff like that, that is just and is necessary and essential. They will usually allow it, maybe with a warning, maybe with a less than satisfying time slot. But I do have to give them props for that. They've allowed ABC to show Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan completely uncut, That's pretty incredible, given the context.
Yeah, I remember the Ford Motor Company paid something like $100 million or $50 million, some ridiculous rights back in, I want to say it was 97, 98, to have Schindler's List shown with, I think, three commercial breaks of about 2 minutes each.
Yeah.
So basically like one break about 45, every 40 minutes.
And of course that's the grandchildren apologizing for Henry Ford.
Yes. But, you know, I don't want to get into too much, but, as someone who lives in the area, you know, there's mixed feelings, but I do have to say that the Ford family has actually done a lot of really genuinely solid community work.
Yes, they have.
So, you know, and I think as a whole, the family really does seem to have turned itself aside from away from Henry's melting pot, which was not a good thing. People talk about the melting pot as a good thing, not the way he meant it.
Oh.
But, you know, we haven't talked as much as I wanted to, and maybe we can get into this a little bit. Do you think any of these shows really manage to avoid being self-serving? Or do you think they're more essentially self-serving by their very nature?
I think by their nature they're self-serving. And I think that's one of the reasons that they work, frankly. If they were trying to be self-conscious, I think that they would seem really silly. Because
also, they'd be the People's Choice Awards.
Right. Yeah, I mean, here you are. You have industry elites awarding industry elites, and sometimes newcomers, and sometimes outsiders. But usually it's elites awarding elites. And so if they're going to act like that it's not self-serving, it would be gross. It would be really offensive. I think that the fact that they're self-aware that it is self-congratulatory and masturbatory to a certain degree is what makes these shows work.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the shows with a good host are the best shows, because the host is usually a step or two below the A-list. And so they're amongst the A-list, they're around them, they know them, and they're allowed to make fun of them with impunity, at least for a night. That's why someone like Jimmy Kimmel is a better host than someone like Ellen DeGeneres, because she is A-list and he is like B and a half list.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably why, you know, another reason why Dave Letterman didn't work, among many reasons.
Yep. Yep.
Although I do have to give Dave Letterman props for coming back the next year to be zinged by Billy Crystal and his writers. do you remember that moment? Have you ever seen the clip?
I have actually not.
It's in the opening to the 97 Oscars, which honored the 96 films. And it's a clip where they inserted him into, they inserted Letterman into the Ralph Fiennes role in English Patient when the plane's going down. And as the plane's going down, he's firing off the guns, telling his Oprah Uma joke over and over and over again. So at least, you know, Letterman had had enough self-awareness to say, hey, I better fucking poke fun at myself, or everyone's going to think I'm an asshole. I mean, hey, and it's not like, you know, people don't think he's an asshole. Hey, I mean, Cher went on his show and said the only reason she went on his show was to call him an asshole to his face on national television. But, you know, no, go on.
I just remembered one of those head-shaking moments. Do you remember when Seth hello?
Yeah, go on.
One of those head-shaking moments. Do you remember Seth MacFarlane hosting and singing the Boobs song?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. We saw your boobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just cringy, cringy stuff.
Well, you know, I can't remember what year it was that he hosted it, but...
It was for the 2012 films, so 2013.
Not a good year to do that.
No.
But I was going to say, I can't remember what year Steve Martin hosted the Oscars, but I have to say, on balance, Martin might have been the best host in a way since the early days of Billy Crystal, because he knew when to get out of the way. He did not overstay his welcome at all. He didn't try to make the show all about himself. And it was an Oscar show that came in 3 minutes under time.
I don't remember his solo gig. I do remember his horrible, horrible performance as host, co-host with Alec Baldwin.
Oh, that was terrible.
That was miserable. John Stewart for the 05-06, I really liked. I thought he was great. When he came back the second time a few years later, he wasn't as good. I really liked Jimmy Kimmel when he was on back-to-back years. I thought he did a really good job. Now, apparently not everyone agrees with me on that. But, hey.
Well, they had to have him back-to-back years because they had to have him be back to make fun of the previous year where there was the La La Land Moonlight.
Yeah, right.
But, no, you know, but we've talked about the Oscars a lot, and that was going to happen. But in terms of the Emmys, you know, you get these dynasties in the Emmys, like with Hill Street Blues and The West Wing, The Defenders, Frasier, and other shows, Modern Family, winning year after year after year. But then you get times in the Emmys where dynasties give way to a quick succession of one-off wins. You know, Modern Family was followed up after five straight wins by the first season of Miss Maisel, the final season of Fleabag, and the final season of Schitt's Creek. The West Wing was was followed up by, I believe it was the first win of The Sopranos, which seemed to be its only chance at winning because the final two seasons of The Sopranos were not well received at all. By some people. I personally love them. I know that they are pretty well rated critically in terms of like Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic scores, but at the time there was this feeling that Emmy didn't love The Sopranos anymore. And that's one of the times where you think, well, I guess it did win its one Emmy, not for its best season, but not for a bad season. And then it wins a second one. But then you have great shows that are only up one time and don't win.
Yeah.
And they get and they don't win because of another dynasty. I'm looking at you, L.A. Law, for fucking up the chance for Twin Peaks to take it.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
I
think that even 5 years later, they were kicking themselves over that because 5 years later, it was so apparent that Twin Peaks was so far ahead of what was happening on TV.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, for Pete's sakes, 90 and 91, right? Shooting in 89 and 90. It still feels revolutionary today. 30 years later.
Yeah, they shot the Twin Peaks pilot in 89. They shot the show in the summer and fall and winter of 89, 90, and then they shot season 2, 90, 91. Yep.
Yeah. And 30 years later, that piece, it's still revolutionary for television, network television especially.
The first like 10, 15 minutes of that show, that's one of the great openings in TV history.
Yeah, and the most, in my personal opinion, the most perfectly executed pilot I've ever seen. Introducing every major character for the perfect amount of time so that we get to see each person and really understand, maybe not, I mean, we obviously don't understand their secrets or what drives them, but we get to know them. At a certain level. Granted, it was a feature-length pilot, which was really rare at that time. But David Lynch was coming off freaking Blue Velvet, and could do whatever heck he wanted. And this is what he wanted. And he took it for every pound it was worth. And, man, what a great show.
This makes me, and I know now, folks, we're getting away from award shows, but this is what happens. This makes me think of pilots, great pilots, and that's interesting because I'm trying to think: is there another pilot that is that great in setting up so much of the cast and the plot lines? And you know, I want to say that there are very few.
The only other one I can think of offhand that comes close is The Deuce. The Deuce has a nearly perfect pilot.
I'm going to go with a different one. As great as I think The Wire and The Deuce are, and The Wire is my number one show of all time, and I think The Deuce and The Wire both have great pilots, I think that for the first two or three seasons of the show, the pilot for The Sopranos is as close as we get to a perfect pilot before or since, with the possible exception of the Breaking Bad pilot.
Yeah. So here's my dirty little confession. When I'm one of the few people that did not buy into Breaking Bad immediately. I decided I was going to watch it all before the final season. So I watched the first four seasons before the fifth season started. I watched both parts of season five live. It took me 2 months to get through the first two seasons. And then I think season three and four were about 3 weeks.
I got through season one in about a day and a half. I got through season two the rest of that day, and then maybe part of the next 2 days, and then I went directly into season three and four. I think it took me maybe 7-8 days to get through four seasons of Breaking Bad.
Yeah. See, and that was season three and four for me, and it would have been season five had I not been watching it live. But even though it took me a while to get into the groove of that show, the pilot is incredible. I'll buy that. It's another one of the great pilots. But
another show. We're going to have to do a show in a few weeks on great TV pilots.
Yes, absolutely.
But
to hook back to the Emmys, then Twin Peaks got screwed again for the return, not even being up for best miniseries.
Well, it got screwed when Emmy decided to change its rules so that it would have to wait until the next year. And then it didn't get up for anything that it really should have, except for David Lynch. And then David Lynch lost to Ryan Murphy for The Assassination of Gianni Versace. Now, I liked The Assassination of Gianni Versace. I think Ryan Murphy is a very important voice in television. Sometimes he really pisses me off because I think as a director, he cannot get out of his way. But I watched the pilot, the first episode of the Gianni Versace miniseries, and that is the single best bit of direction that Ryan Murphy has ever done. But you cannot tell me that the pilot for Gianni Versace is better than the entirety of Twin Peaks The Return.
Yeah.
And you know, Twin Peaks The Return, I had Twin Peaks ranked as my number 18 show of all time. The Return brought it so close to the top 10 that I almost have a dual top 10 right now for my shows, but Twin Peaks sits just outside at number 11. And if I didn't add in miniseries and documentaries to my list, and there's only miniseries that high up on the list, I don't get documentaries until quite a bit later in the list is of the 30s and 40s, but Twin Peaks would be my number 6 show of all time.
It is my number 1.
Oh, and I have no problem with anybody putting it as at number 1. I mean, look, I only have problems if somebody decides to not have it in their top 20 because what the fuck are you watching? And actually, if you've got stuff I've never heard of, then I'd be able to respect you more. But you know, I was talking to somebody a few months ago, and I mentioned Twin Peaks was my number 11, and they were like, that wouldn't even be my number 111. My number 1 show is The Dukes of Hazzard, and I'm thinking to myself, who the fuck am I talking to?
What are you? 60-year-old.
And the thing is, the guy isn't like a good old boy, but The Dukes of Hazzard, your number 1 show?
I've seen, I think, 3 episodes of Dukes of Hazzard, and that was way more than enough.
Yeah.
If I really need to watch charming Southern men in really long car chases, I'll watch Smokey and the Bandit and get it all over with in an hour and a half.
Hey, because at least then you have Burt Reynolds.
And someone who's truly charming.
But this show didn't go exactly the way I wanted it to. But I do think that we've had quite a wide ranging discussion. But I do want to get some thoughts before we wrap this up, and that begins with if you could redo, say, 5 wins for the Emmys or 5 wins for the Oscars, what would they be?
Oh.
And they could be even any category.
Well, we just discussed probably 3 for the Emmys. Twin Peaks Season 1 would have won.
Yeah.
Twin Peaks The Return would have won, and David Lynch would have won for director. The Wire would have won for season 4. At least.
Absolutely. For me, it would have won for its first 4 seasons, and had a strong contention for season 5.
But I mean, like, at least season 4 has to win.
Oh, season 4 is for me, and maybe other people will disagree. I don't know about you, because it's been a while since we've discussed this, but I don't know if any single season of television has been as impressive as season 4 of The Wire.
If it's not number 1, it's number 2.
It's
absolutely incredible.
And you know, the thing is we're both teachers in real life, so that whole thing about education and what's going on in schools, I'm sure definitely speaks to both of us.
Yeah. I guess we'll stick with David Simon and we'll do Simon and Lynch. I think Plot Against America should have won Best Miniseries. Just an incredible work. And now I'm biased. Plot Against America is my favorite novel, and I think that it was an incredible adaptation of that novel. But what a crowning achievement.
Well, I still think that Homicide on balance was the best show of the 90s outside of maybe those 2 seasons of Twin Peaks. And the fact that Homicide was never up for best drama, although I have a feeling we were talking about, you know, how close do movies and shows come to winning. I have a feeling that with the consistent writing, directing, and acting nominations that Homicide kept getting, that Homicide probably was just outside the top 5 for drama series every year. I think it probably consistently hit like 6, 7, 8.
Oh, yeah.
I think Homicide was probably almost up, definitely for season 1, probably season 3, and then I'm going to say seasons 5 and 6, probably. It had a really good chance at getting in. Andre Brower, fuck, man. That guy should have won more than a single Emmy. The Wire should have had more than 2 writing nominations, period, as the totality of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the season 3 finale and Community could have won so much. The fact that show got skunked like it did is a crime. I mean, there's one of the top 5 sitcoms,
one,
one of the top 3 sitcoms.
Let me get like 1 animation nomination.
Maybe. I mean, look, I love Freaks and Geeks. Freaks and Geeks was on for 1 season and got 2 writing and 1 directing. Now, that's not wrong.
And
it definitely deserved it. But you have shows that were on for years and people loved them and responded to them. And the critics and the audiences are sitting here going, the fuck are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, Community, And this is not the measure by which greatness is determined. So don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. But Community, which was a very small show, small but loyal show, won the TV Guide's Best Show on Television award, I think twice, during its 5 years on network TV. So that really speaks to how devoted of a fan base it had. My point isn't to say that that means it's great. My point is to say that when a show like that gets into that level of popularity, like, where are the awards? Like, why aren't people listening?
Well, you know, I like the fact that when, you know, Donald Glover was doing the junket for the award season for season one of Atlanta, people brought up Community and his role there, and he always spoke very highly of Dan Harmon and crew, and I think that was nice that, you know, here's one of the biggest stars on the planet in the music industry, one of the current geniuses of television, and he's not forgetting his roots.
Yeah, well, and he has flat out said that the longer he's been away from it, the more he appreciates it, the more he sees, like, oh, you can't do this on TV.
He's realizing
how punk rock we were.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing is one of the funniest things I heard was that he got left off an email or a text chain with Harmon and the rest of them discussing the movie, and he got put in. He's like, "What? How'd you forget about me? Yo, we gotta do the movie. We gotta get the money together. We gotta convince the studio to do this. Come on, guys, let's go." I mean, you know.
But, and they all thought he was too big of a star to do it.
Yeah, and that's why, because they were like, but we didn't think you'd even, we didn't want to interrupt you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really do think in some ways, you know, we may be going through a new golden era in television comedy. You know, what with the fact that we still have certain shows like Maisel and Russian Doll, Blackish, and a few others left. But that renaissance of great drama that really began with The Sopranos. I mean, it took 20 years before The Sopranos to lead up to The Sopranos, but it was everything from The Sopranos up until the end of Breaking Bad and Mad Men. So, what about 16 years of truly outstanding drama seems to have died down a little bit, and that's sad for me to say because, you know, Better Call Saul. There are moments, as much as I love Breaking Bad and bring Breaking Bad as number three all time and Better Call Saul's up in the lower 30s, there are times where I look at it and I'm like, you know, there are moments this thing does things that are even better than Breaking Bad. But I'm not sure, I don't want to get into the Better Call Saul show that I'm going to eventually do once that show finishes up, hopefully next year. Hopefully they'll get to shoot the season and we'll get it next year, and then
they're going to start shooting in July.
Excellent. So sometime
I'm
in,
not positive it was July, but it's this summer they're going to start.
So sometime in 2022, within a week or two of the show, hopefully, let's say the show ends on a Sunday, that Friday we're doing a Better Call Saul retrospective. But one of the things is I think that one of the reasons it's so great is for some of these characters in this setting and this story, you've got a decade or better of watching them. And that's something that, you know, the Emmys tend, I talked about the Emmys having dynasties, and I think that's part of what happens is you get familiarity. People talk about, well, Emmy doesn't like freshman shows, or Emmy does like freshman shows. It used to be back in the day, you know, people said, well, of course The Practice beat The Sopranos. It's the new kid on the block. It's going to have to wait its turn, just like ER and NYPD Blue did earlier. But you look back in the 80s, and you had things like The Cosby Show winning for its first season. You had Hill Street Blues winning for its first season, 30-something, L.A. Law.
Well, and then the current trend, which is over a decade old now, is that the lead actor award has gone to a freshman or a final season show every year for over a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't really say they hate freshman shows. They might not always go with them for the best series award, but they're watching
yeah.
them. They're paying attention.
Yeah, and that's the thing. There's these perceptions that I kind of want to point out. I'm not sure are true anymore.
Yeah, yep.
You know, conventional wisdom is conventional for a reason. But it's not always wisdom.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Oscars, you know, I'm interested in what's going to win. I haven't seen all the awards this year, the nominated films, I should say. I need to see Minari. I did just finally see Sound of Metal, and I'm not going to get into that right now. But I do want to say for those out there who are wondering, well, who's this guy to talk about award shows, especially the Oscars? Just another fan, but in the end. But I will say 2015, 2018, and 2019, I managed to see every single film nominated in every single category before the Oscar show. And in 2016 and 2019, or 2016 and 2017, I managed to see all but maybe 1 or 2% of the films, simply because they were no longer available for me to see. But you know,
or not yet available,
or not yet, which is what happened to you with what was it? Was it Cold War? And
and
Capernaum, I think, were the two films for 2018. You were really close to having a 100% that year too, but some of the foreign films and animated films escaped you.
Yep. Cold War came out like 2 weeks after the Oscars. Had to wait a little longer for
Yeah, and, you know, and I want to bring this up because this makes me think of it. You know, it's interesting that this year so many of these films are going to be available. Although I did go looking for The Father, and I can't find The Father streaming anywhere. But maybe
Friday it goes up.
Yeah, because I thought it had already gone up, but I was going to ask because like I said, I've been very busy with things. I'm not paying as close attention to the Oscars this year as I have in previous years. I was also busy the last couple of weeks thinking about older shows in preparation for this one and other shows that I've been doing. Also looking forward to next week's show and prepping for some shows that unfortunately due to circumstances beyond our control will have to be postponed, and that brings us to this part. I do not have any word from Carl on what will be coming up on the rest of Deviant Legion, but I will say that next week's show on Borgen has been rescheduled for another time. One of the guests is unable to do it, so we are putting that off indefinitely, but it will eventually come back around. Hopefully May or June we'll get to Borgen. But in lieu of that, next week we will be doing a show on the landmark British miniseries, Brideshead Revisited. And I think that'll be a very interesting conversation next week. Got you coming in and hopefully one other guest, so that'll be fun. And then our next director will actually be a different approach. We usually spotlight one director on this show. However, in April, we're going to be looking at the geniuses of Studio Ghibli, particularly Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, and I do hope I'm pronouncing the names correctly, but the guys who gave us My Neighbor Totoro, Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away, Grave of the Fireflies, The Tale of Princess Kaguya, and so many other animated classics. We are probably going to focus mostly on the Ghibli work, but since we're not just doing Ghibli, we're going to focus on that, but we will have to mention things they did before, like Lupin the Third and Nausicaa. Now, if you haven't seen Nausicaa, everyone out there, and you like fantasy, you owe it to yourself to hunt down a copy of that movie.
Nausicaa, not to step on next week, April's toes, but is kind of proto-Ghibli.
Yep.
Definitely was brought into the fold. I think they started the studio right after.
Made. Yeah, and, you know, you look at Nausicaa, and then you look at the Final Fantasy series, and you have to know that Sakaguchi and Amano were definitely inspired by some of the illustrations in that. Because, of course, if I remember the story right, Nausicaa had been a manga that Miyazaki had done himself and decided to adapt into a movie. It was definitely out there in Japanese culture at the time. So, you know, for the Final Fantasy series, which began in 86, 87, and Nausicaa, I think, was, 83, 84, that definitely gives enough time for that to percolate.
Yeah.
But you know, that's enough of a preview of the show in about 2 or 3 weeks. We'll decide on the air date next week. But yes, ladies and gentlemen, we're probably coming to the end of this long and rambling show on award shows. But, you know, that's what happens. I really think in the end, award shows are just for fun, and they wouldn't be anything if not for television. You know, it might have been great just seeing somebody read the winners the one year at the Golden Globes, but that's mainly because you didn't have to listen to a whole bunch of drunken speeches. But at the same time, those drunken speeches are sometimes really fun to watch, if only because of the oh my God factor. So do you have anything to say before we go?
Oh, I think we touched them all.
Excellent. So with that, I think we'll both say goodnight, and thanks, one, for putting up with this very rambling, loose show. It's been fun. It's been different. Next time we'll go back to our typical 2-3-person panel and the discussions you're used to. So have a good weekend, and definitely keep watching movies and television and enjoying it. That's the thing. Let's all enjoy our entertainment. That's what the show's all about, hopefully getting you guys to be exposed to different things and sharing the love of this filmed entertainment. So, again, that brings us to good night.
Good night.